following message is brought to you by Christ Reformed Baptist Church, Newcastle, Indiana. For additional messages and to learn more, please visit www.crbc.faith.
Well, this morning's Sunday school class, we're going to go back to church history. It's one of my favorite subjects. It's one that I enjoy doing. And so we're going to be looking at the 14th century. We're closing in on that epic century called the 16th century. 16th century is when we all understood the Protestant Reformation as happening, and that's when we as Protestants get the most excited. We get to hear the names of Luther, Calvin, Zwingli. Ooh, ooh, ooh. But yet, to get to the 16th century, we still have to go through the 14th century and the 15th century. Believe it or not, all of these things are coming together, coalescing with one another, to bring about the spurring on of how the 16th century Reformation actually was able to be started and play itself in its important role. As we start the 14th century, we have seen that the Roman Catholic Church is at its epic power. Innocent III basically could snap his finger and the whole world would be his oyster. It's not so readily for the Roman Catholic Church here, though they still are dominant in understanding of history. In fact, this 14th century, all the way through, even up to today, Roman Catholic Church plays a humongous role in the world history as well. But we will see here in the 14th century how many of the decisions made in the past years are going to help undo what the Roman Catholic Church thought it was doing so well at. One of the first things that we notice is in 1303, it's called an Unum Sanctum. Unum Sanctum. It is here that Pope Bonifacius VIII issued this papal decree. The desire was to maintain church authority. It started to wane at this time. The 1200s, or the 13th century, was when the power was at its highest. Here, it doesn't take long before the power starts to diminish, and they go on a downward spiral that they have never been able to overcome. Never again will the Roman Catholic Church have so much power, prestige, and influence over the world's thought pattern, as well as political aspects. Now, it's not to say that they aren't a big player today, but their role has greatly diminished. Anyways, it was to maintain church authority over King Philip IV of France. Why? Well, because of the simple fact that when he was excommunicated, he sent men to seize Boniface from one of his palaces, and Boniface is rescued, but shaken, and he dies soon afterwards. We see that the idea, the ability of the Pope to excommunicate somebody and cause a great stir has decreased greatly. If the kings don't feel like they are being excommunicated out of heaven by the Pope, what do you think that's going to have its role on the lower echelons of the common people? Especially like the peasants and such. If the king doesn't feel threatened in the 14th century, well, when you get down to the lower ends of the 15th and 16th century, you're going to see that the peasants aren't going to be so responsive to the cardinals kicking them out of church. Now, this has a great concern for the Roman Catholic Church, because in 1304, a new pope, Benedict X, had enemies in Rome. The result of the conflict over who should be pope. Sadly, Benedict dies, supposedly eating poisonous figs. How did he get poisonous figs? He just picked them up somewhere and started eating them. No, actually, people believe that he was actually killed, murdered, because of the need and desire of power. In 1305, the French influenced the College of Cardinals, results in the selection of Bishop of Bordeaux, who becomes Pope Clement V. The people in Rome opposed to a Frenchman as Pope riot. He's the very first one who wasn't Italian to be Pope, or somewhere in that Eastern European aspect. He's one of the very first French dudes to become Pope. and it did not bode well. So what happened? Well, believe it or not, at the request of King Philip, Pope Clement V moves his court to Avignon, away from the hostility of Rome. Now, you'd be saying, well, that's pretty interesting. It is actually interesting. In fact, depending on who you talk to in Roman Catholic history, this is a very light issue, or it's one that they try to ignore altogether. One of the reasons is that their own doctrine prevents them from really trying to actually interact with what has happened here. This period is called the Avignon Papacy, which is also known by Roman Catholic historians as the Babylonian Captivity. It's a cool name, isn't it? It makes you feel all warm and fuzzy. It was a period of 1309 to 1376 with seven successive popes residing in Avignon, rather than in Rome. The situation arose from the conflict between the papacy and the French crown, culminating basically that Philip IV gets to get his guy. He has his man. And because he has his man who's his best buds, they move the court from Rome, from the Vatican, to Avignon. Now following this, the absence from Rome is sometimes, as I said, the Babylonian captivity of the papacy. Total of seven popes reigned at Avignon, all French, and all under the influence of the French crown. In 1376, Gregory XI abandoned Avignon, and we'll talk a little bit about that, and moved his court back to Rome. But after Gregory's death in 1378, deteriorating relations between his successor, Urban VI, and a faction of cardinals gave rise to what's called the Western Schism. Basically, that started out and culminated in the idea that there's three popes. Now, when you are arguing that you're in the line of succession of Paul, of Peter the Apostle, and you have in your history a time in which there's three dudes who are claiming to be pope, you have problems. You have very theological problems. And sadly, I think one of the aspects of church history, and I appreciate the fact that we're doing this, is that most Protestants don't realize this and don't actually try to figure out how theologically corrupt the idea of this succession line is. Historically, doesn't play out very well. Obviously, it wasn't because of a spiritual matter. It was all about politics back in the 14th century as to who was pope and who wasn't. When the French can claim to have influence over an entity like this instead of them influencing the French, you have problems. And we see what happens when what they call influencing the temporal versus the spiritual. The temporal is the political means here. And if we are, I'll be honest with our own history, we can see the evangelical church going down the same pathways as the Roman Catholics does in influence in desiring a political power. The Lord our God has never encouraged us to accumulate or seek after such things, but to seek out first the kingdom of God. And it's through our evangelism, it's through our desire to see people come to Christ, is our greatest means of influence in our culture. And sadly, we want to take a shortcut and think that we could do it through political means. And we can see how this works. I want to touch a little bit on the Crusades. This is the last of the Crusades you'll ever hear of. It's in the 14th century. There's a crusade against the Tatars. The Tatars are basically Mongols, basically in the Mongolian area. And what has had transpired is the Mongolian Empire is quite huge at this time. I wish I had a map to show you. But they reach all the way into Eastern Europe, all the way to the Pacific Ocean. It is by far the largest empire land size ever. Now, granted, British Empire was large, but it had pockets here and there. It was not a continuous land mass. But the Mongolian Empire was breaking up at this time. Genghis Khan died, and there was other Khans after him, but as with any great empire, you need great leaders. You don't have great leaders, you're going to have problems. And so what has happened is that there's this guy named Vistus the Great, and he decided that he was going to help one of the Khans out versus the other Hans. And so he needed a blessing, though. He got the blessing from the Pope. And believe it or not, his army was made up of Lithuanians, Ruthenians, Russians, Mongols, Moldavians, Poles, Romanians, and the Teutonic Knights. Teutonic Knights are famous for being those that grew back in the 1100s that went down to Jerusalem and captured it, and they've existed all the way even to this time period of the 14th century. So his army met the hordes at the Volska River, slightly inside Lithuanian territory. And there, they failed miserably. They had cannon, they had all the things for him, but they didn't have some strange reason, they still lost. In fact, he lost several of his brothers in this war, and this guy, Vistus the Great, never really regained after that. And so the last Roman Catholic crusade, per se, was an abysmal failure. However, overall, the Crusades had enormous influence on the European Middle Ages. At times, much of the continent was united under the powerful papacy. But here, under the 14th century, the development of centralized bureaucracies, aka the foundation of nation-state, was well on its way in France, England, Spain, Burgundy, and Portugal, and partly because of the dominance of the Church at the beginning of the Crusading era. So basically, what happened is, because the Crusades were so successful, the nation-states were thinking, well, why do we need the Roman, Roman Pope? In fact, what happened was that they went down to the Middle East and brought back technologies. They brought back understanding. In fact, most of their castles before the Crusades were made out of wood. We don't get the big, beautiful stone things that we think of when we think of castles until after the Crusades. It was during the Crusades that the king saw, hey, if these guys ever come up to attack us, we're going to be in trouble. We need to have buildings and superstructures like they do. Also, along with trade, new scientific discoveries and inventions made their way east and west. The Persian advances, including the development of algebra, optics, and refinement of engineering, made their way west and sped the course of advancement in European universities that led to the Renaissance in later centuries. And then this is interesting, is that the Lithuanians. The invasion of German crusaders prevented the formation of the large Lithuanian state incorporating all the Baltic nations and tribes. So without the Crusades, Lithuania would have been a gigantic place. Today, it's just this little country in the Baltic region. And we can see that it was destined this way because of the way that God providentially used those Crusades. All right, any questions on the Avagan and Crusades aspect of things? Yes?
The Western schism, I think you called it, yes. I'm not familiar with that history. Could you expand on that a little bit? Sounds like to me that the French monarch was wanting to control the papacy, per se, and so he starts to do that, and they move it to this Babylonian captivity time era,
right,
out of Rome, the seat of power, and they were observing three popes, like one in the east in Constantinople, one in Rome now, and then one in this Avagan, if I'm pronouncing it right. That was known, the Western...
Well, the Western Schism happens after this move. What happens is, and I appreciate the question, the Western Schism actually happens after the Pope Gregory moves the papacy back from Avagan to Rome.
Okay.
When he moves it back to Rome, the French did not really care for that.
Right.
So after him, there started a second line of Avagan popes. The last Afghan anti-pope, which they call the anti-popes. So you got this anti-pope.
Because of that, the Roman Catholics.
Yes, the Roman Catholics.
Right.
It's called Benedict XIII. He lost most of his support in 1398, including that of France. And after 5 years besieged by the French, he left. He fled to Perpignan in 1403. The schism ended in 1417 at the Council of Constance after two popes had reigned in opposition to the papacy in Rome. So there was three popes claiming rightly to the throne after this huge catastrophe here, the French influence on the papacy.
Right.
And it didn't get itself cured until the 15th century.
Yeah.
And so we can see that this starts working its way downward towards the Reformation.
Yeah.
If you're going to claim ultimate biblical authority and you can't even figure out who's leading with, you have a schism over it. how's that going to reflect on the populace? Now, granted, there's other things that are causing the populace to be distracted by all this, but it does come to fruition, just like the Crusades and the consequences of that. I think that we need to realize in and of ourselves there's consequences to everything that happens. Good consequences and bad consequences. The word consequence is a neutral word, per se. It generally has negative connotation because that's how we use it. But there are positive and negatives. For example, believe it or not, in the 14th century, the Chinese invent wooden type to print. Well, where do you think that went to? It went west. Now, granted, the printing press and the movable type didn't get invented, but being able to print stuff happened in China in the 14th century. Believe it or not, the Mongolians and this stuff, the Italians, start going east to do trade. Well, guess what happens? They catch a disease by the Mongolians, and they bring it back to Europe. This disease wipes out over a quarter of the population, known as the Black Plague, or what we call the Black Death. Black Death in 1346. Or 48, I'm sorry. The Black Death reaches France, Denmark, Norway, Britain, striking a population weakened by nearly two generations of malnutrition, and around one-third of the people in the affected areas die. Wipes them out. Now, 1360, the first phase of the Hundred Year War ends in a tenuous treaty. Now, it starts in 1346, and you're like, well, that's not 100 years, that's only like 20. What's going on? Well, the Hundred Year War is a stop and start between England and France. In fact, in 1346, we see Edward III of England invades France, beginning in earnest the Hundred Years' War. His army of 10,000 men, believe it or not, using the longbow, crushes the French's cavalry at the Battle of Crecy. Now, why is this important? Well, because we need to understand how all this stuff develops, and it does influence the Christianity and the mindset of people back then. For example, the Black Death reappears in England and ravages Europe in 1361. The survivors of the first wave are better able to resist the disease than were the people in general during the first wave in 1348, and so the second wave of the plague is less severe than the first. They've grown immune to it a bit. Immunity takes place. So, now, here is the problem, and I wanted to touch base on it, was I did touch base on the idea of the Western Schism. Here's some more information on that. The Roman mobs demand that the College of the Cardinals elect a Roman Pope, and under this pressure, the Cardinals elect Urban VI. Then this is rejected, and a second election selects a Pope, Clement VII, who takes his papacy back to Avignon. There are now two popes, Urban VI and Clement VII, in Avignon. They are to excommunicate each other. Then France, Scotland, and Spain will support the claims of Pope Clement. England, the Holy Roman Empire, and most of Italy will support Urban VI. And some of the church want both popes to resign in a new election, which is what happened, and so you get three popes. Two of them refuse to do things. Now, what's interesting is a biblical historical aspect of things is that... where is it? Got my notes all skewed. Ah, 1328. The system of chapters of the New Testament is created. 1328. All the chapters that we have was created back then by Cardinal Hugo de Escaro. So I thought that was an interesting factoid. 1338, the Diet in Frankfurt in the Holy Roman Empire decrees the Empire's Emperor may be chosen without papal participation, a continuation of the breakdown of the influence of the Roman Catholic Church.
The Roman Emperor, brother?
The Holy Roman Empire?
Yeah.
Yeah, the Holy Roman Empire that was basically controlled Germany, Italy, and most of Eastern Europe. You used to have the papacy was involved in choosing who. Remember, they crowned several of them, And one of the last ones would be Charles. And we should see that arrangement between he, the Pope, tensions evolve with a guy named Martin Luther later on in the 16th century. All right, then the thing about the 14th century is that mysticism is on the rise. Mysticism. Influencing the Roman Catholic Church, mysticism. In short, it's the beginning of a new mentality and idea of an individual's relationship to God. The Catholic Church of the day was weak in authority and greedy for land, money, and power, both in the papacy and local clergy. Lay people were disillusioned and began to seek a more personal Christianity. Saints. Well, use the word saints. Like Catherine of Siena are great examples of this. She actually believed that she and Jesus had this marriage. She had this marriage to Christ. Very strange kind of thing. And she was a very influential person, though, because of the vacuum made by the problems here. In fact, she was the one who encouraged Gregory the 11th to move the papacy from Avignon to Rome. This mentality of personal relationship with God was a threat to the church because they had always had a monopoly on the mediation between man and God on earth. Reformers like Wycliffe and Huss protested most of the inventions of the church, like many of the sacraments, that perpetuated this monopoly. However, in the long run, it's easy to see how this transformation ushered in the Renaissance and its humanism, rationalism, and people were no longer reinforcing the status quo connected to the church and its universities, but searching for truth and God in and through themselves. Again, consequences of actions. Because of what the Roman Catholic Church has done, people got disingenuous about it. They didn't care for it. They wanted to seek it after their own. And so you get people like Catherine of Siena rising up. The mystics take a great influence over a lot of people at this time. And sadly, the mysticism of the 14th century continues even through to today. All of our mystical aspects of what we call religion today can go all the way back to this time frame in particular. Now, I'm not saying that mysticism didn't exist beforehand. What I'm saying is that the influence of today's mysticism is generally dated back to the 14th century. With that, we do see the rise of a couple of guys. Name John. Yeah. Wycliffe. And John. Huss. Oh, that's well John Huss one. That's okay. I think he'll forget. Believe it or not, John Wycliffe is in Oxford. And he actually transforms Oxford into the spiritual center of England. It's when Oxford is on the rise. The Oxford campus and the idea of thought is given strength because John Wycliffe helps find it. In fact, he's the one who decides to go back to the scriptures. Now, granted, he's Roman Catholic, per se. He never leaves the church. But you can see the fruitation of the need of the scripture as its authority. In fact, Wycliffe transforms Oxford, and then he gets expelled from Oxford, just like any good reformer would. He's expelled because he translates the Bible into English, and he trains the lay preachers to spread the scriptures. We see it as a response to the Roman Catholic Church and also the mysticism that's been rising. John Wycliffe sees this and steps out and says, hey, we need to translate the Bible. He's the very first one to ever translate it out of Latin into the common language. A lot of people think that it was because of Luther's desire to do it. But no. This goes way back. Even Tyndale and all others go back to John Wycliffe. Even the King James Bible, the Bibles that we have today, all modern translations, gets their roots to John Wycliffe, and why we call one of the great entities the Wycliffe translators, who desires to translate the Bible into all languages. They're closing in, basically, on it, I think, from last time I remember talking with someone about that. I think they're well over 70% there to all known languages. So I was like, whoa. But John Wycliffe influences a guy named John Huss. John Huss gets a hold of John Wycliffe's writings and said, man, this is a great idea. And so he promotes, in the late 1300s, he's like 1389 to 1390, so we'll talk more about him next century, because he actually bridges both centuries. And let's just say that John Huss doesn't make friends with the Roman Catholic Church. When they dig your bones back up and burn you afterwards, that's pretty bad stuff. But we'll get more into what John Huss's reforms did, do, and cause next time we get together. But it's good to cite the idea that in 1398, John Huss begins lecturing on theology at Prague University, spreading Wycliffe's ideas. His ideas about training preachers and about the scriptures as the sole authority. Believe it or not, scholastic theology continues to develop as the 13th century gave way to the 14th, becoming ever more complex and subtle in its distinctions and arguments. There's a rise to dominance of the nominalist or voluntarist theologies of men like William Ockham. The 14th century was also a time in which movements of widely varying character worked for the reform of the institutional church. As we talked about, Wycliffe and his guys were named Lollards because of the region of Lollard, England. And so it's called Lollardly and the Hussites. These spiritual movements flourished greatly. And as I said, we'll talk more about the Huss Reformation the next time we get together. All right. Any questions? Any concerns? It's a brief overcap of it.
I'm not familiar with Oxford University. Did it start off as a Roman Catholic institution? Or was it, how did that work out?
Yeah, the university itself doesn't exist yet. It's still just a college training ground, and John Wycliffe was there to make it a spiritual matter. So yeah, I would say it started originally probably as a Roman Catholic enterprise.
Right, right.
But slowly but surely the Protestants overcome it and take over it, per se. And then now it's held on by secularists.
Just one thought in the context of John Wycliffe. We have some family members who are very devout. They would call themselves Orthodox Catholics. And it's helpful to understand that Catholics are not all the same.
Right.
There is a network of independent, just like you have like autonomous Baptist churches, there's a network in the United States of independent Catholics that believe that they're like the fundamentalist of Catholics.
Okay.
So they reject the Pope, the current Pope, so on and so forth. So I learned a lot of this from our family members, and coming back to John Wycliffe, one of the distinctives I picked up on talking with them is that they think it's liberalism to have translated the Bible into any language. They were using a phrase I noticed. They were saying that Latin is the unchanging. It was the unchanging tongue. I don't know what that. There's obviously a theology behind that.
Right.
You know what I'm saying? I picked that up. So I thought that was interesting because they see the Second Vatican's decision to say Mass in the vulgar tongue, English or French, or wherever you're at, they saw that as a huge move of liberalism and loss of purity.
Right.
And so, thus they separate from the Roman Catholic Church.
It's
this really interesting dynamic to Catholicism. It's not as monolithic as they try to sometimes appear to us as Protestants. And it's good you pointed that out with the popes, and this is another tidbit of information to let them know. We're splintered a lot, but you guys are splintered.
Oh, yeah. In fact, it's one of the main things that the Roman Catholic apologists try to use is we're just one church.
Right, right.
Well, you guys, gazillion churches. And I had asked the question. I said, well, I'm sorry, but last time I checked, you got, you've got your Pentecostal Roman Catholics, you've got your Catholics who believe that Mass should only be done in Latin, you have this kind of Roman Catholic, what's up with that? And I get, the only response I get is, we're all under the Pope. Ooh, okay.
But not these, that I'm talking
about.
Well, yeah. They think he's the Antichrist. They'll even say he's the Antichrist.
Well, there's Roman
Which
Catholics.
It's very interesting. You got some Catholics saying that the current Pope Francis is the Antichrist. So
there's guys who are raised in Roman Catholicism who hate this Pope, denounce him. Yeah. And I'm thinking, well, why don't you leave Roman Catholicism? Well, I can't do that because it's the true church.
It's the mother church.
Right? But you have a disconnect somewhere. Mm-hmm. And the problem that they have is, well, if Latin is the tongue, why was the Bible translated from the original languages into Latin? You have Jerome.
There's two types of Latin, though. There's classical Latin and ecumenical Latin.
So, and the church would use the ecumenical Latin, but it definitely...
So they reject classical Latin?
Well...
Is that...
I don't know the position on that. Yeah. They just want it to be in some Latin.
It's funny that it's unchanging, but yet there's two types of Latin.
Yeah, there is. I mean, that's the whole problem with language in and of itself and trying to argue from one superior to another. And even you get that debate within the King James debates. Mm-hmm. Well, it is the translation because it came down from heaven and Apostle Paul was speaking King's English.
Well, the Bible translations were originally like Greek and Hebrew. Why don't they translate it into Greek and Hebrew? Why do they want it to be in Latin?
That's the thing. They think that's the dominant, because it was the dominant Bible of the day. You got to remember that the very few translations were Syriac, and then finally Jerome translating Latin, which is a good thing. No one's disagreed that that's a bad idea. Latin was the language spoken in Western Europe. They couldn't read Greek. They couldn't understand Hebrew. They were losing that. And so that's why they would have this translation. But with any translation, once a church group falls in love with it, it's very hard to make change. No.
Well, some of our family members, they said they used to go to a Catholic church, and the person who'd be reading their Bible, it was in a totally different language. They didn't know what he was talking about. I don't know if it was Latin, something like that, but they didn't even know what he was saying, what he was talking about. So do you think the Catholic Church would maybe submit to maybe like a little bit of like translation, you know, so their whole congregation actually understand what they're actually saying?
Well, that's a good question, and it demonstrates the fact that the Catholic Church isn't monolithic. You have these people who want the quote purity and do all things in Latin. In fact, Mel Gibson was one of those guys that was involved in this. He actually kind of made their understanding name more public. You know, I mean, that sect of Roman Catholicism no one really knew about until Mel Gibson came on the stage and claimed that to be his own desire for purity of the Latin. The problem that they have is that the Vatican II promotes vulgar language in all of its relations, so there's a tension there. And I don't think they'll ever get it back. I think that the Roman Catholic Church has so far gone down a road that they can never go back to making itself, even correcting any of its theological errors. When you claim that the Pope is infallible, well, you can't change things unless you want to deny the infallibility. Well, if you deny the infallibility, well, that opens up a can of worms that nobody wants opened. And so they're stuck. And they're stuck between this idea of, well, this is what the church has always believed. And yes, the Pope, he just interprets it a little bit differently than he probably ought to. Tensions. And this Pope is causing the greatest tensions for at least conservative Roman Catholics in a long time. And I think it's a good thing, personally. The more and more exposed Roman Catholics are of their false ideology and theology, the better off we as Christians can be, personally.
Yeah, I've heard that there's this one Pope, and he says that he's like, have people like bow down to him, like he's like the little Jesus.
Mm-hmm.
He called himself that or something.
Well, actually, that's they believe that he is his right-hand man on earth. He is Christos. He is Christ on earth. So that's not too far gone for any of the popes. All the popes believe that. Whether they promote it or not is something of another nature. But they truly believe, yes, as Pope, I am Christ's regent here on earth. So you need to treat me like you would treat Christ. Very scary. Yes, Josiah.
Well, I read in a book about Pope Francis that he did not want this big bedroom, and he was supposedly humbling himself mm-hmm. from not being Christ. What would you say about that?
It's interesting, Pope Francis, because he comes from South America.
Argentina.
All South America. Argentina is in South America, last time I checked. The problem, though, that I would be questioning, does he still live in that very small bedroom today? A. B. Why does he have, doesn't allow the immigrations into the Vatican City like he wants all other countries to do? He's very inconsistent in his understanding of things, Josiah. He puts on this display of showing piety, like, I want a small bedroom, but in reality, he can't, because the Roman Catholic Church has never really demonstrated that in the first place. He still holds to ideals that are opposite of Scripture. It doesn't matter how pietistic he may look, he can fool the world in that, and the world loves him for it, but he's no closer to Christ than any other pope has been. All right, any other questions? Awesome. Let's close in prayer. We'll take a break.